tracks, that was the Violent Femmes in the background. For those of you in the 80s, remember that?
Yep. I remember that. I think I even saw them once, didn't I? Anyway, my adult old brain, right? The 80s definitely destroyed a lot of brain cells. So we have with us today, James Rovira, and we bounced back and retweeted each other a little bit in the past couple of days, so there's definitely evidence on punkonomics.org if you can't wait. And of course, as usual, once we cut, once Jesse cuts, cause he does that, so credit where credit is due, cuts the PDF, the MP3, the podcast, then I can, upload the link to the interwebs.
and I also do the quarterly report. We're like 100% on the reports.
We are.
Yeah.
We are, because we are old school, responsible, hardworking people, kids today. And apropos then, so shortly we will have this on all the regular channels. Like I said, the main hub being punkonomics.org, but then it goes all over the place. And I will also put more information about James and his initiative to take over the world and fix education in the process.
I just like a corner.
Just a corner of the world. I know.
20 acres.
20 acres. That'll do, right? You know? Let's have 40 and I don't know, a mule.
There we go.
Yeah.
A couple mules.
40 and a mule.
Yeah, it was a nice idea. So we would start with Felix giving some hate about testing, because we want to talk about how do we assess the entire education system, individual students, the job, all assessment. And on the show we had several times, we even have our opt-out people, so shout out to all our opt-out activists who are gaining momentum around America quite remarkably. So people are pushing back. That's very encouraging on so many levels. So what assessment, testing? You complain, you're coming home always and complain.
Well, the thing is that, like, intellectually, we're aware that tests are supposed to gauge our, like, what we know. But the way we always see it in school is, like, it's just a thing that we have to do. And we're lucky if we get, like, a good enough grade for what we need. So it's not about how much we know, it's about how much we probably should have known but don't.
Oh god.
Yeah, pretty Kafkaesque, I would say, right? You know? And let's not forget the aspect, my favorite nonfiction, well, one of my favorite nonfiction books, Michel Foucault's Discipline and Punish. That the tools do that. I mean, that they put you under the boot, you know? Let us, it's important you remember your place.
Yeah, it's true. It's like, there's maybe one or two classes where I see the test as literally just something that, and this is something that I actually do. I can just knock out the test in about my latest time, because some students time me for some reason, was 3.5 minutes, and I got a 96% on it. And it's not that it's an easy test. It's that it's a test where if you study, you'll get an A. Because it's a test that, and this is, you know, a very controversial and radical idea, it's a test that actually functions based on what the student does know, as opposed to what the student was supposed to have known based on the decisions by some administrator in the Capitol.
It's a good test.
A
good assessment tool, in a sense.
Which is exceedingly rare today.
And then at other times, in some one of your favorite topics and one of my favorite topics, which I've qualified, you're sitting there and you're hating it, aren't
you?
Well,
yeah, I mean, especially...
I don't want to say so, because just in case.
Yeah. Some of my classes just, I feel like, and everybody feels like...
with an H.
The teachers focus on just tricking us. Like, we see questions or answers to questions that don't make any sense, and it's not just like the one where you pick that you put, oh, that's obviously not it, the first one you eliminate. It's that something that could reasonably have been it, but because it's a tiny detail that, you know, brains just forget, we don't worry about it when we're actually reading the stuff or listening to the lecture. And so it's just a couple negative points here and there can add up to a lot, especially when it's just mindless topics or mindless details that wouldn't affect any part of our life ever again.
So that's an important element where it's not necessarily where, oh, I don't want tests or it's
half
the
tests,
quality of them.
Instead of like focusing on testing details, if somebody is actually like they like the topic and they want to know more about it, they're going to remember the details because it's something that interests them. But so that's going to happen whether you test it or not. But I'd say tests should focus on broad strokes at the very least, if not like just being good, but the broad strokes of like what the topic was, what the chapter was, what the unit was. Have it so that if you studied, even if you don't like it or not, if you like it or not, you'll get a reasonable grade based on just like how much work you put into it. Not like how much you happen to memorize whether this guy's name was that and this is the day he died and this is the thing he did. Just one person that doesn't affect anything. Instead, like, we should know what actually happened in context as opposed to just like one guy who lived and died and did one thing.
Yeah, the context actually.
But you know that you've hit it on the point. It's one of those situations where if you're really interested, then you're going to remember things. But you know, let's take it a little bit further. Adult education, returning adults. Mm-hmm. For some bizarre reason, most of these schools are just so hyped up on your SATs or your LSAT or your GRE. Somebody who's been in the work field for the last 20 or 30 years who comes back to school does not remember any of that stuff. Furthermore, those that actually are able to get into higher education, their knowledge is recent knowledge, not the knowledge that they've had, you know, from high school days from 30 or 40 years ago. So it almost like it puts the adult returning student in a situation where, okay, you're not able to get into the higher education schools with your GRE or whatever, you know, litmus test that they have out there. And there's very few schools who actually give credit for adults who have actually been in the working field.
Kind of life experience.
Well, right, life experience.
Life experience doesn't mean anything on the SAT, but high school students, I guess you could say we do have the advantage going into college because we've just spent the last, 12 years learning how to take a test.
Right, and but it penalizes adults, though. Adults,
good schools and graduate programs, skills. Definitely. So people should know that, I mean, the higher level you go, typically, there more attention is paid. So actually, your experience, SAT is only one thing, one part of it. It shows a certain skill, and the committee of people will look at your, what have you done? To establish whether you're accepted or, I mean, that's how it should be. That once again, because it's difficult to measure the quality of a student, by some kind of industrially produced, especially as our, you know, the testing industrial complex is hiring, you know, is producing a shoddy product in terms of these testings. So they don't really reflect that much.
Right. It doesn't. I mean, you might have somebody who just graduated with an MBA and you put them against somebody who's been in business their whole life. Mm-hmm. There's really no comparison.
Yeah.
At all. Because that person who just got their MBA is going to get their feet wet in the real world, which is completely different than what you learn in school.
And that's why MBAs, by the way, tend to, and different kinds of business schools, tend to favor students with, first of all, the good ones always require real-world experience,
right,
by the way, when we're talking about business, as well as the best ones always do, as well as they actually favor a well-rounded education over a narrow training in the tools. And like James was saying before, it may be something to gently underline, when you look at rankings of schools, you're absolutely right, and I rub a lot of people's noses with it, the entry salary, like you mentioned the subject, right? The entry salary, and sometimes you can look at, there's data about it, right? What's your entry salary based on undergraduate degree, graduate degree, whatever combination thereof, what's your salary 10 years later to try and capture that, you know, how much you go up in the job that you do have. And many people, I think, will find it surprising. Sure, the top is populated by the science in high demand, driven by technology as well as by, like James was saying, the lack of qualified people. So low supply, high demand, if you will. And then you have kind of the liberal arts, the general academic fields dominate over the practical fields, it's certainly in the higher education. So, you know, let me say one of the things that I've been talking about, economics, maybe for all the wrong reasons, 15th place, one of the highest of the non-scientific. International, you mentioned that you want to do a kind of a multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary or interdisciplinary business, which I think is an interesting idea. International business is ranked not as high as economics, but still relatively high in the pack in 34. It's out of 160, I think. Non-international business is ranked, again, it's not my ranking, it's corporate America's ranking, yeah? Ranked in the 60 something, I don't remember, 69, 66, something like that. So even corporate America, and certainly business schools, graduate business schools, value a well-rounded education, value these kind of upper-level cognitive skills, as Benjamin Bloom called them, as opposed to brute fact that today there's really no excuse, right? My God, you just look it up, right?
Yeah.
On your phone. Sorry.
That's probably a big reason for why our math skills are degrading so much, at least among high school students. Because we have a teacher who, even if our teachers agree with us, they're like, yeah, we know that you'll always have a calculator that can do this that we're teaching you to do in your head. So all these skills we're giving you for these years are completely useless, but you're going to get graded on it anyway, and your college and your future all depends on it. So it's, it's difficult to get invested in that.
I have to address that.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you a little analogy that I pass on to my students about how to understand your own education. Okay, I want you to start out by thinking about different kinds of machines. Right, the first and simplest kind of machine that you can think of would be something like a hammer. It's really only good for one purpose. It lays there until you pick it up. It doesn't do a thing until you use it. When you put it back down, it's an inert object again. The next kind of machine might be something like a washing machine. It can run on its own, but it only does that one thing. Okay? Mm-hmm. A third kind of machine is a computer. It's very sophisticated. It can do multiple tasks on its own, but its limitations are based upon the programming that you instill in it. All right? Our educational systems are trying to turn students into hammers. And the better schools are trying to turn them into washing machines. Okay? Hammers, washing machines, and computers, even a computer is not a human being. Because for a computer to be human, it would have to choose its own values and create its own programs. Okay? And that's what schools should be doing. Okay? Now, there is a point at lower levels where you're basically treating students like hammers, you're teaching them how to add and subtract and stuff. But the goal of pedagogy is to maximize human potential. That is the ultimate goal of any educational pedagogy, is to maximize human potential. Right? I have a PhD in English. I want every student in the country to have a year of calculus, not because they need calculus to balance their checkbooks, but because of what calculus will do for their cognitive abilities. Math, every different type of math is a different way of thinking about the physical world. All right, mathematics is a language that we use to describe the relationship between material objects. And every different kind of math that you learn is a different way of thinking about how objects interact with one another. You know? Mm-hmm. So if your teachers are telling you, you know, you're not going to need this because you can do it on a calculator, they don't even know why their jobs exist. They don't understand the purpose of what they're doing.
Well, they're forced to follow a predestined program written by idiots for profit reasons. So,
right.
In defense of
testing to determine, I mean, standardized testing to determine student ability and how much they've learned, that's really new, okay?
Right.
I mean, we've had standardized testing, like the IQ test, because all, you know, way back, right? That was determined to predict a student's possible chances of success in higher education.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the IQ test was like a college entry.
Right.
And it was just designed to predict the likelihood that a student would be successful later on.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't designed to predict what their success, to measure what their success was.
Right, a very particular kind of intelligence, if you will.
Right.
I was shocked
right.
coming to America that everybody talked about IQ. I remember, and I'm coming from the Middle East, right? You know? Well, and I remember when they did IQ for us in elementary school, kind of by the time I was in high school, they stopped because my teachers in high school said it was public high school. Yeah, I said that, no, it's discredited. It's really very cultural determined. It doesn't really tell us much. Right. We're not doing IQs anymore. And the next time I hear about IQ is when I'm putting my kids in the... you know, late 20th century, early 21st century into school in America. Again, they're starting to do IQs. I was like, what?
And what? IQ is total BS. Like, one time, I took two IQ tests, one right after the other. On one of them, I got a score of 116, and on the second one, I got a score of 175.
It's very random. Like kids say
well,
today,
obviously
right?
the second one was accurate, right?
I don't think any of them were accurate. I don't think it means anything at all.
That's what we call a big standard. I think they should, more than calculus, I think people should actually learn statistics. In fact, I would have, when we do our, either together or separately or what have you, right, or in some kind of massive network, better education for the 21st century, I will have a general education course that requires, everybody's required to take, that'll be about statistics. Not so much about doing them professionally, of course, or even an early prep to doing them professionally, but as a consumer, right? And of course, the title would obviously be Lies, Damn Lies, and Statistics. And the title of the class.
Which, it's a great title.
Which, again, you know, again, a quote, of course, from Mark Twain, right?
I mean, the testing that you're just describing is repeating back information. That's teaching you to be a hammer, of course. Right. I mean, it's like making you, it's trying to make you stupider than you are, you know? Right. That's why, you know, all these subjects need to be integrated somehow. Mm-hmm. And that's why a final project, what you've learned should be measured by what you can create with what you've learned. Mm. Yeah. Not how well you can check off boxes on a Scantron.
So indeed, instead of exams, or certainly bad exams that are simply easy to administer and cheap to produce, it's difficult to assess. Project-based, I must admit that I barely use exams anymore in any class. Again, I'm not belittling people. I'm fortunate to teach general education, kind of interdisciplinary
right.
courses, so I get that, you know, I'm not good for me. It's not a technical course, and I don't have these exigencies, and I certainly don't work in the K-12 system where you're really the administrators are forcing you to be a hammer as a teacher too. But project-based are notoriously difficult to assess. How do I argue that you know, my kids have been wrote all these bits and pieces of text here, and I think they learned something. How do you know?
Yeah.
That's tricky business.
Now, see, I allow students, like in my literature classes, I allow students to write creative responses to the literature that we're reading. Mm-hmm. So let's say they read I had one student, we were studying Milton's Paradise Lost one semester, and that's an amazing text, okay? It's an amazing text. It's a great work of the imagination, and even with students who have a difficult time reading, once I get them through Milton's syntax, you know, they get drawn into it. It's really something. Mm-hmm. So this woman wrote a short story that reinterpreted Paradise Lost.
Ah.
And it was set in like 1950s America. Adam and Eve were a young couple, and the snake was like the pastor of this church.
And that was the assignment? That was the assignment?
Yeah,
you told them to write creative writing in somehow engaging with with Milton's text. That was kind of the assignment.
Right. And yeah. I bet when they do creative projects, they have to write a nonfiction prose account of how their creative work engages the source material.
Ah.
And how it's an interpretation of it, how it responds to it. You know, what different values may come out of the way they've reinterpreted the work. Okay, so they have to think rationally about it and write about it on that level too. And I think that should be a part of any kind of project-based assessment.
And how many
should have to write an essay explaining the project?
Right, the kind of the meta-critique, as it were. Yeah. Of course, that's very labor intensive for you to really read and give them some feedback so they do it better if they didn't do it so well the first time around.
Yeah, well, that's just it. See, if you want to give the best kind of education, you can't let a machine do it.
Mm. How about rubrics?
It's labor-intensive. It's labor-intensive. Now, you know, group work, I mean, realistically, in the workplace, students are going to be working in groups. Indeed. They got to be part of a team.
Absolutely.
So they need to start learning how to do that in college.
Mm-hmm.
You know, group work should be a part of their educational experience and a regular part of it.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a part of every single class, but it needs to be there somehow. For final assessment, I don't know. I've never used group projects for final assessment in a class. Mm-hmm. But I'm, you know, I'd like to see what people do with that if they do. You know, I really can't, you know, I can't speak to that.
Sure, there's a whole social level there where who carries how much weight, but I like to think there's a whole lesson in that. My personal solution to this is if you do a lot of them, then kind of the law of large number kicks in. So if you were in one bad group, it's not going to kill you.
The thing in my experience is that teachers aren't opposed to like working hard at their job and giving us projects that they have to like grade subjectively, which is more difficult.
Mm.
It's just that by and large, when we do projects, it's at the very end of the year after all the finals, because they can't justify spending time doing an interesting, enlightening, intellectual project when instead we could be practicing scantrons and learning how to analyze rhetorically some stupid, boring passage that they pulled from a book somewhere.
For the standardized testing.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, we are in Florida. I don't know how it is out there in the Midwest. Probably not worse than Florida, right? That's not hard.
Yeah.
You have to laugh, right? But we have wonderful weather.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah, you do, especially this time of year.
No, it's not easy. No, but the thing is that, I mean, I misspoke, because and I have an ongoing argument with several, I mean, friendly argument with several colleagues about precisely how do you deal with giving, feedback, because it sometimes can become, unless it's a small senior seminar, literally impossible given the workload to give the kind of attention you would give to a written piece and give them exact feedback and how you would develop it differently. You know, detailed feedback is just impossible to do while keeping 4 hours of sleep time. So a lot of people use shortcuts like the infamous or famous whatever rubric, right?
Right.
And I'm a big rubric skeptic, but I understand why sometimes it might be, you know, a second...
A lot of times
solution.
I've noticed that rubrics, students like obey the rubric and we figure out what needs to be done and we do it. But a lot of times what we spend the most time on and work the hardest on is not like quantifiable by the rubric. Like the creative thing that really makes our project stand out has nothing to do with the rubric other than sometimes here and there, displays some kind of creative something. And the teacher just always checks that off because it's impossible to grade.
Mm.
You know, so it's like people don't want to work.
Boring, minus 5 points, right? But that would be inappropriate. Then there goes your teacher evaluation.
Well, it'd be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Also, we don't have teacher evaluations.
Right. Yeah, they are evaluated. Again, yeah, they're evaluated by bureaucrats. Right?
Yeah, how well we do on the test is how the teacher's evaluated. So.
Oh God.
Yeah, they're right. That's how it works.
The worst part is that,
it's like a Soviet era nightmare, really. You could, like a caricature almost.
But the saddest part about the teacher evaluations is that not only is it based on a test, it's based on the same test that we have to get into, like, the next grade. So a teacher's entire livelihood depends on getting unmotivated students to work on something really boring when even they wouldn't want to do it.
Yeah.
So it's a difficult situation.
Well, it's hard to be
enthusiastic. It's a gulag, man. We are in Soviet Russia.
No, really. I mean, it's a big scheme of mine.
It is. It's a gulag.
Yeah, as a crazy foreigner that you know, that I have the background from there, you know, I'm always like, I'm jokingly saying, I wish my grandfather from Czechoslovakia was alive. I'd be, you know, I'd sit with him over a bottle of vodka and tell him, remember all those stories you told me about how miserable life used to be? Well...
Well,
guess what?
Here it comes again.
Here it is again in the most unlikely of places. But, you know, talking about these assessment and rubrics, maybe it's time, you know, to remind, I mean, maybe some long-term listeners would have heard it before, but at some point when my daughter, who's not with us today, wrote, she had, it was when she was in public school, I'm pretty sure. Oh, anyway, God. Remember the story, right? Yeah. She had a book report, and actually once she wrote a book report, and we really were honestly kind of just prodding her and letting her express herself in, I don't know, third grade or something on, and she did really poorly. And we thought it was pretty good. So next time around, me and my wife, and she's actually in the humanities, she's a PhD, and she's a French 17th century literature expert on fairy tales. She comes on the show sometimes. We both basically wrote a Florida public school third grade book report on Charlotte's Web. And we got, a B minus?
B minus.
We got a B minus.
Yeah. Two PhDs got a B minus in third grade reading.
And we took it actually to a friend of ours who was a teacher. It was kind of a bit of a double agent, I suppose, in that sense. You know, a teacher in the same school, but not our daughter's teacher. And she very quickly told us what happened. It was the rubric. Elements of the story were not sufficiently separated as they were supposed to in the rubric, right? You present the environment, present the characters. I mean, to me, it's a little bit more of a mystery. I'm sure this maybe rings more, you know, tragic to you, James, because you're in the humanities. We blended the environment with the characters a little bit in one paragraph. I mean, we really took our time to kind of dumb it down in quotation marks to a third grade student and even worked with her. I mean, okay, you understand these are all to make it as authentic as possible. But that was our big sin, that we didn't write clumsily and mechanically enough.
Yeah.
Five paragraph essay. My wife actually graded for Pearson for a while last summer.
Mm.
And she talked to me and she was grading, writing assessments. And basically the way you have to write to score high on their writing assessment would be completely unacceptable in any college class.
Right, there you go.
Right.
You know, I mean, so again, if high schools are under this intense pressure to get students to score on this test, that means they have to teach them to write badly.
Right. And our leadership on both parties think that by beating up the teachers, you'll actually, metaphorically, hopefully for now, you actually get better outcome out of them.
Teachers and support them. It's always easier to do that.
Yeah.
You know, that's a pitiful lack of imagination. Now, I know there are a lot of teachers who aren't doing their jobs. They're out there. I have three kids in school right now. Mm-hmm. Actually, five, count two in college. I have three kids, you know, coming up K-12. And you know, most of their teachers try to do a good job. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I see them going on this thing called Study Island. It's a website that they do their homework on. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're assigned, these exercises that they haven't covered in class yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what kind of an assessment is that? You know? And then if they're doing it on the computer, what happens if the computer freezes up and they have to restart the test? What happens if they're a kid and they just get distracted? You know? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the system is causing a total reliance on computer-based testing, and the computer-based testing isn't actually testing their knowledge of the subject or their ability to do math or whatever. It's mostly testing how they interact with the technology.
And that technology is typically very subpar. Again, we're talking about interface design from a previous decade.
Not to mention, it was written by people who the last time they stepped out of their like apartments in Washington D.C. was the 50s. So it's so condescending and stupid, and it makes nobody. Enjoys. Nobody finds the cute animations of monkeys jumping on the letters interesting or funny. They just, it's like, this is ridiculous and we feel demeaned and looked down on, and it really doesn't make for a good testing environment.
I must say, I'm encouraged.
How does that emotional reaction affect your performance on the test?
I'm encouraged that the kids, you know, are angry about stuff, one, and sometimes as I go through my extended midlife crisis, I suppose, sometimes I haven't bought a red sports car and I don't have a young girlfriend. You know, what I think is that somehow I think that the kids are better, you know, it's the old people that are annoying me, you know. I embrace my inner infantile, I suppose, or something. So that it encouraged me actually in some sense. that when I look askew at that kind of thing, I also find that in the higher education, the fact that precisely the kids really want focus on academia. And in the name of giving the kids what they are supposed to want, I think a lot of the leadership thinks that they are supposed to be receiving all of these fringe benefits as part of their education, where the kids really do not want that. They're not interested in that. Yeah. They want focus. We and feel freedom. Like
they want to learn, man. They want to learn. Learning is a great source of pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Overall, the way that I can sort of, I just speak for high school students here, if you'll allow me. It's like, we don't want gimmicks. The administrators think that, oh, if we give them laptops this year, they'll do better on the tests. If you give us better tests, we'll do better on the tests.
Duh.
You can't start tacking on all kinds of random stuff to a building that's foundations are made out of mud. It's just, it's ridiculous to assume that students will do better if you give them plastic toys. We want school, not, you know, a glorified, boring playground where we don't get to sit up for, well, we only get to sit down in a desk for 7 hours. It's like, they're wasting our time, and everybody in K-12 knows it. Like, you go into school, first day, start seeing paper apples on the board, and like, friggin', it's just, everybody sees it as a waste of time, except the people who are sending out the money. And it's ridiculous.
It's a very bureaucratic phenomenon, by the way, these things that the machine, you know, that the human machine, the bureaucratic machine ends up recreating, and we have this initiative and we have that program, and then that it becomes the bureaucracy lives off of itself. Nobody wants to, nobody cares, yet this is how we do it, this is how we've always do it, and we continue doing it. And it used to be that we associated that with these kind of centralized Soviet economies, and but you know, a sclerotic bureaucracy run by people who are not coming out of the trenches of the actual production process, whether it be computers or education or anything for that matter, not accountable to anybody but for themselves or for their higher ups. That it's a characteristic that was true of the Communist Party in Soviet times, and is now sadly true of a large chunk of the for-profit private capitalist bureaucracies, still just as fat, just as sclerotic.
I feel like as the baby boomers start to just, you know, become
don't
more
say that. Don't
powerful.
Say don't say
I know where he's going with that. Don't say it.
Drop dead. You
yeah, drop dead.
No, I mean, start to. I mean, they have all the power. They haven't talked to a teenager in decades. It's gotten to the point where they see a 17-year-old and a kindergartner as basically the same, with a few years apart. Well, that may be true, but this is where, like, people are growing the most, is, like, discovering themselves. And the one thing anybody who's met a teenager in the last decade can tell you is that being condescended to, or condescending to them, and us, really, is the best way of finding yourself ignored by a teenager.
I know, James studies the period where they used to say that children should be seen but never heard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, honestly, you don't hear us, you just read us online now, but...
Off to the mines with you.
Yeah.
Retweet.
Yeah, I mean, Oscar, I felt the same way when I was 17. I mean, I hated school, you know. I certainly did not appreciate anybody talking down to me. And, you know, I wasn't really motivated to do anything in school. And this was before high stakes testing was brought into play. But, you know, I read the complete works of Shakespeare on my own. You know, I read a bunch of George Orwell on my own. I was reading Plato and Aristotle on my own. This is all between the ages of 14 and 17. So it's not that I didn't have interest and that my mind wasn't agile and active. It's that school was killing it, man.
Yeah.
You know? And I think a lot of times what needs to change is that it's got to be about what we can do, what we can produce with this knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you can put your hands on anything and do something with it, you know, that's very gratifying.
Yeah, you got to geek out on knowledge. That's kind of how I like this.
Especially in, like, math classes and stuff, show us what people actually use it for. Because, like, learning a formula and then the teacher says, okay, now use this formula of trigonometry to find out how tall the tree is based on the length of your shadow. I'm like, do tree scientists actually use this to find out the height of trees?
Well, you can actually, I mean, along the lines of your example, I remember actually going through that with you, I believe, and even getting you historical material on this a little bit. Put it in any kind of context. So you tell the story, here comes a narrative now, and maybe, I mean, James will agree with me, maybe you have to write a fiction story about it.
No, Daddy.
About the measurement of the, you know, the obelisk or something, you know, how they indeed developed these kind of today-by-today crude antiquity-era mathematics. At least give it in the context of the antiquity when this was taking place.
Or, yes, something, but, I mean, what they're giving us now is maybe that was too, you know, educated an example for what they actually show us. Because us, it's like, this is a table leg. This smaller table has a similar leg. Now figure out the ratio between the two table legs. My mom works extensively in, like, designing houses and stuff, and I can guarantee you she has never used a formula to find out which table she wants.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
You want to...
The thing is, the principles behind all design are mathematic. You know, the difference between an engineer and what my dad's an electrical engineer, and he recently retired, but he was last assigned to the Global Positioning Satellites, okay, if they're down in Merritt Island. But the difference between an engineer and a tinkerer is that the engineer understands the mathematical principles behind his or her design. You know? So, you know, I think math instruction is definitely something that could be embedded in the creation of products, the analysis of data, you know? My wife wanted to go to med school, but she could not get through physics because she didn't care about baseball.
I exactly understand what you're saying. That was the examples. I remember flunking an IQ test for the same reason of not understanding baseball.
I on a math problem, I actually had to spend more time Googling about baseball. Seriously, baseball. Because it said, like, if this player is on this point in the baseball diamond and they run this far, and I'm like, what? I don't know any of this terminology, and I have to Google baseball before I can do my math problem.
A lot of what you guys are saying is one of the reasons why I was inspired to use video games in teaching on different levels. When you're talking about actually math, algebra, and even calculus, I'm very excited about this small company that, and by the way, I shouldn't say anything commercial on the radio, so I'm not telling you to do it, but any person out there listening and having a kid and a mobile device might consider checking out something called Dragon Box, which is, I think, quite fascinating because precisely it's a cute little mobile game that employs the basic algebraic principles. So without even realizing why I'll move the black fish next to the white fish or from the right to the left. And actually what you're doing is simplifying a formula without realizing slowly it takes you through it. But all those applied instances are relatively readily available in the virtual world. Just like you can write epic heroic narrative, playing a fantasy game online, and the kids find the context compelling because they actually are playing the game. Have cases in which you can build stuff and employ engineering principles. And sure, a lot of people think, oh, you mean you learn something out of playing this shoot 'em up on Xbox or similar? Perhaps not so much, but there are many, many other games that are extremely sophisticated and creative and allows for that contextual application of knowledge. Though it doesn't cut off at one of the big deals. I mean, you still need the teacher, you still need to do the math. It's just that instead of using the example of Farmer Joe is making, I remember helping you with that, making a field for his pigs, for geometry, you might be able to maybe build a cool spaceship.
Or like, the worst part is when the word problems are ridiculous in their stupidity. Like, I recently on a test, I had one where it's like, this person's backyard has like this angle and this side. And then when I finished, and it was like find the area. When I finished it, I was like, okay, so this person has a backyard of like 600 meters. Okay. And then, I mean, it was the correct answer, but it's
a
just,
1%er.
Or even worse, even worse. There was one where it's like a windmill, and we were supposed to find out how what its like what its period was, which is like how often does it hit like a certain point in when it's spinning. And so we figured it out as a class, because this was in class, and it was 20 meters in radius, so like 40 meters in diameter, and it's made a complete revolution every 8 seconds. And we realized that if you were actually to ride that thing, you'd die, because your brain would be crushed against the side of your skull.
Astronaut training. Like,
and that's supposed to make us want to learn?
But you see, you have to know the math to know that, right?
Well, I mean, I guess you do, but it's not something that inspires us to become mathematicians, that's for sure.
Well, maybe you harness your inner cynic, you know what I mean? Which is a lovely good way.
You shouldn't have to in
critical
school.
Thinking. Hypercritical thinking. Let's take it all around, kind of back around to, you know, to impose a very minimalist structure, you know, it's against my politics and basic philosophy, right? So James started this whole story about kind of reinvigorating the education system. And we do have a lot of ill-conceived initiatives and a lot of well-meaning ill-conceived ones too. It's not some kind of cynical plot by Phoenix to take over the world. I mean, just you singling out Phoenix because it's, you know, maybe one of the biggest, nastiest for-profit schooling system. But even the Gates Foundation, which generally does decent stuff, is involved in really very ill-conceived initiatives. It seems that the decision makers are at best ill-informed. So you're saying, you're looking for an idea to start an individual, independent initiative, kind of get a virus right in the matrix, as it were.
Right, right. You know, and, you know, we need to talk about innovation in education in terms of students actually learning stuff and what they're able to do. Okay, I mean, I don't want to call what I'm doing an innovative enterprise in education, because so many people use that language.
Right.
And I'm afraid of it. You know, if somebody tells me you're an educational innovator, I'm looking at what they're selling.
I know.
You know? what I'm trying to do is gather resources to see what we can give. You know, the most important thing we need to understand about our educational institutions is that they are the stewards of our country's intellectual capital. Okay, mm-hmm. We are entrusting our brains, you know. Right. There's very little that's more important than that. I mean, it determines the limits of our future, what we do with our education, you know, in our educational institutions.
Oh, yeah, you cannot overstate it, absolutely.
You know, we need to see students as people in whom we need to invest, rather than profit centers from whom we can suck money out. You know, the business principle I would like to operate the institution on is I call grassroots capitalism. I think capitalism is great. I believe in private ownership. I believe in it so much. I think more people should have. You know, and part of that would be faculty having, you know, ownership of a place on the board in the institution, employees having ownership of the companies that they're working for, at least partial. You know?
No, don't be shy. You shouldn't be shy about, I mean, I don't know, politically maybe, right, you need to be, but it's fascinating. The powers that be, the oligarchs, the bureaucrats are the ones who shy away from this because it, of course, is a real threat to them. But in terms of economic ideology, this is actually one place where the smart, you know, non-doctrinaire socialists are in full agreement with the smart non-doctrinaire conservative is a weird word, Austrian economists, libertarian types.
Right.
Precisely, a democratic workplace, sometimes it's called market socialism, but at the same time, if you speak with serious libertarians, they have no problem with that too. The notion that some detached people with no accountability or connection to the actually core mission of the company should make all decisions, it's not capitalism, it's not market, it's elitist and anti-democratic.
Yeah, it is.
And inefficient.
It's counterproductive for the system as a whole. That's a big problem, because, you know, you have a small group of people acting only in their own interest. You know, the heck with everyone else. I mean, how else are they going to think? Now, the thing is, employee owners, you know, even if employees as a group only have 10 or 20%, even if it's not, you know, the whole thing, employee owners are still invested in the profitability of their company. You know, there's still going to be a certain rationality behind their decisions that's going to be, you know, one in which, create wealth.
Okay? If they have decision, power to make decisions.
If they're invested and they have power, and they're able to, you know, make these decisions.
Right.
If they're owners, you know, at least partial owners.
Because sometimes you have that kind of scam where you have these types of places. I mean, actually, there's that. It's not a scam. It's just a different thing that doesn't accomplish, I think, what we're talking about here. Where you simply part of your pay package is stock in the company, but you don't really have any, but then you answer to your little boss who answers to a bigger boss, so it's complete rigid.
Right.
That doesn't cut it. That becomes to some extent, encourage workers to work harder a little bit, but that doesn't cut it. It's all about the decision making. The decision making is, I mean, maybe even it could be that people separate from that company are the majority owners or of the stock of the company and its capital. It's a decision making process that has to be increasingly in the hands of the people that operate the business. That's what makes the huge difference. I think it's a very important thing, and it's doing wonderful stuff in different parts of the world, and increasing in America today, this whole movement for democracy at work and worker managed cooperatives, and it's non-idealistic and it's highly efficient, and those companies are doing well, a remarkable success rate and return on investment, so I'm a bit of a cheerleader.
Right. Well, I mean, it is producing results. That's great. I'd like to see that, you know, because I believe it will. I mean, if, you know, even if we're going to take a straight capitalist line and say that people are going to be motivated by self-interest, if you distribute self-interest as widely as possible in ownership, you know, so that it's still private ownership, but it's more widely distributed, the entire system is bound to benefit. It'll help everybody, you know. Instead of trickle down, it should be build up, you know.
Right, trickle down doesn't exist. It's gush up, right?
right, you know. And I mean, I think... In colleges and universities, you know, as we were saying before, we need to understand they're completely different kinds of creatures. It has to be from the ground up. That's where your creative and intellectual abilities are, and that's where your educational product comes from. You know, faculty. And then students.
Exactly. I wanted to be even more radical. I mean, and I think it's important, and I try to even hear it, bring the students in to the decision process. Certainly within the classroom, they should have more control. The ability to design their own assignments as the core part of a course, as well as sit on, as far as I'm concerned, and I've advocated for it, vehemently, sit on committees, voting, not just observing.
Right.
Yeah, let's have a high school where the students run it.
That. You know, I was... the Graduate Student Association president, the year I was serving in that position, I was on the university committee for expenditures. So every single department on campus presented their budget to that committee asking for, this is what we need and this is what we're spending it on. I was a student, man.
Yeah.
And I was engaged in that level of governance.
And that's, you know, rare and far in between. Where was that?
Drew University in Madison, New Jersey.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard about it.
Yeah, and there's an undergraduate representative as well.
Again, sadly, not a typical structure. I mean, they're not alone, right? But that's why I wanted you to give them the credit they deserve, absolutely.
They deserve it. And I went up to the vice president for finance after, and that was a grueling process, let me tell you. Oh, my God. But I went up to the vice president for finance, and I thanked him after the whole thing was done, and I told him how much I learned. How grateful I was for that.
Right, that's a massive...
That's a meaningful part of my education.
Of course. That's another thing, because people do, critics of certainly K-12, and it applies to colleges overwhelmingly too, are correct to point out that we say, oh, we're raising American next generation in a free democracy, yet the school is about as democratic as a Babylonian empire. They don't even have basic human rights in school, not even habeas corpus, not even anything, basic constitutional protections. So no, we're trying to produce drones here. So what the value of participating in the management and operation of an institution? Talk about practical education.
Yeah,
it's huge.
Yeah,
and you feel like you have control and you can make a difference. So that really, that's what they should be doing if they want to teach leadership, not have events where everybody congratulates themselves for being wonderful.
Let them be involved in the decision-making process.
Yeah.
That's where people learn leadership and then see the consequences of those decisions.
Yeah, but I think, I think what you're doing, and definitely, we'll post all that stuff and see, what people say, and I've heard other things like it, in fact, still under wraps, but I'm trying to talk with an online graduate institution that's trying to do that globally and maybe do some volunteer teaching and work with them a little bit. Once again, of a sharing operation run by the faculty, percentage based. So in many interesting parallels. I'll share it with you, in case you're not familiar. So I think there's a lot of, just like in manufacturing in America, there's a lot of people who are trying these new models and doing surprisingly well and shamefully not being reported upon much on the media because, corporate structure makes the media not like to talk about that much. The same thing could be, certainly a beginning, a process that could lead to significant improvement in the education, which you are very eloquent to point out just how critical, fundamentally critical. In many ways, America today, we're still living off the fumes of prior successes. And if we don't get our act together now, then 20 years from now, we'll be a third world country. Maybe 40.
Right. We're racking up massive debt. And I mean, productivity has not been what it needs to be to,
non-investment.
Yeah.
Our bridges are falling apart, and so are our kids. And today, especially, human capital, particularly more important. Though we still also need to have functioning road systems. Despite Amazon's drone program, So yeah, it couldn't be more important, but to try and end on a relatively positive tone, there are a lot of people like you and others are thinking and putting together ideas in a grassroots way, because I'm afraid that like you say, these big educational reformers are, by the time they become big educational reformers, they're already in the pocket of the wrong people.
And even if they're
they're not reformers anymore.
No.
That's the problem. They quit being reformers. Well, my website for this project is anazoaproject.org, anazoaproject.org, and we are a 501c3. So we can accept tax deductible donations. And to really make a school like this work, of course, it does take a lot of capital. It takes a lot of support, and we're looking for people to support it.
Yeah, and some foundations, there's a lot of money into it. The thing is, they need to stop giving it to those, again, to the usual suspects and start throwing around a little bit more to some to things like yours.
It needs to. Yeah, they're going to keep getting the same results if they keep, throwing this money at the same kind of people. It's not going to work. It's never going to work.
We'll promote you vigorously, no doubt about it. And again, in the local people, if they didn't pick it up, you'll see multiple references coming on to the interwebs. I mean, the more I like it, the more I'm going to stick with that funky word. Nobody ever used it, not even in the 80s, by the way. It's just a funky
My son
term.
Steven uses
Lolcats
it.
Lolcats
used
it.
I think he's joking.
Well, if lolcats use it, then that's... Can't
used
be more used. It's passé for lolcats.
Yeah, ever since the death of Happy Cat.
The death of Happy Cat. Okay, a moment of silence.
Yeah, rest in peace.
Rest in peace, Happy Cat. Oh dear. No, but yeah, so we'll definitely put that on the blog and you know, and keep linking about that to keep this conversation going, and you know, hopefully.
Sounds great.
Well, absolutely. You wanted to say something, Felix, before we are? We're still, you
know, I don't know. I think
Jesse
said
stepped
piece.
Out. We can like lock the door and just stay on the air, you know, and on a guerrilla radio until the police comes. But yeah, what was it? What do you think about stuff like that? I mean,
I think honestly, the only way to help is by multiple approaches at once, and this is a very, very powerful way of approaching it. It needs to be, you know, coalitions of students and teachers and activists and everybody working together to try to get rid of all this stupidity that seems to be running everything.
Let a thousand flowers bloom. It didn't work for Mao so much, but maybe it'll work for us. So.
I don't know exactly how much flowers are going to help.
Yeah, well, you know the expression. It's a nice kind of, it's a pluralist, and pluralism is really a very pragmatic way of looking at things. Try a lot of different things. And but then allow a kind of an interaction between them, some a real free market, not as often it is as it is termed, that will allow the successful models to flourish. Let them try. If they fail, okay, try again. Employ, you know, practice what you preach to a large extent. Because we don't know what the future is. In fact, if something we know, that people who tell you what the future is and exactly how well prepared they are for it, then you want to stay away from them, because
they're the type of people who anticipate hoverboards and zombies and hide underground in like giant bunkers and stuff.
Yeah, they are either, I tailor to students sometimes. I say, are people who promise you knowing the future or reduce complex phenomenon to, and say, it's a simple, in economics, often you hear somebody say something like, it's a simple matter of supply and demand. And one of my standard shticks in principles is, anybody who tells you that, there's either of two things. Either they don't know what the bleep they're talking about, or they're lying. It's somewhere on that continuum, typically, right?
Or they're crazy.
Well, crazy maybe, right? Yeah, that might be. Or indoctrinated.
Yeah, crazy. It's all the best people are.
Yeah, it's crazy as, well, to go back to Michel Foucault, right? It's all degrees, right? It's crazy is, in one context, crazy is creative. In another context, crazy is put to death, right?
Yep.
Right.
It changes over time and space and time. Yeah, we're definitely on time. Listen, you know, I could go on. We stay in touch. I enjoy our online interaction, and definitely we'll post updates to this. What can I say? You know, good talking to you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was good talking to you and your son. It's great talking to both of you.
Yeah,
I'm very glad you're both on the show. I'm grateful for this opportunity.
Education.
Yeah.
My pleasure. Let's do it again. Well, let's go do what we have to do and say bye-bye and, you know, see you on the interwebs.
Yeah. All right.
Yes, you will. Talk to you later. See you later.
Okay, right, folks, you've been listening to Punkonomics here at WPRK, Winter Park, Florida, the voice of Rollins College and the Best of Basement Radio. And we'd like to remind you that all opinions stated here today are solely of ours, not of the management, students, or staff of Rollins College or WPRK. So,
however, we are absolutely right.
Even when we're wrong. See you again next week. Take care and be safe.
The program did not reflect the views or opinions of the station, its management, or employees.
WPRK in Winter Park, Florida.